my carpet, and had afterwards behaved as if I no longer existed, packing into boxes everything I'd left in my old room in his house, and sending them by public carrier to my flat. Time had proved me right about Moira, but the unforgivable words had remained unforgiven to her death, and it had seemed beyond. On this October evening, though, perhaps they were provisionally on ice. I, Ian Pembroke, the fifth of my father's nine children, had from the mists of infancy loved him blindly through thunderous years of domestic infighting which had left me permanently impervious to fortissimo voices and slammed doors. In a totally confused, chaotic upbringing, I'd spent scattered, unhappy periods with my bitter mother, but had mostly been passed from wife to wife in my father's house as part of the furniture and fittings, treated by him throughout with the same random but genuine affection he gave to his dogs. Only with the advent of Coochie, his fourth wife, had there been peace. But by the time she took over, I was 14 and world-weary, cynically expecting a resumption of hostilities within a year of the honeymoon. Coochie, however, had been different. Coochie of all of them had been my only real mother, the only one who'd given me a sense of worth and identity, who'd listened and encouraged and offered good advice. Coochie produced twin boys, my half-brothers, Robin and Peter, and it had seemed that at last Malcolm Pembroke had achieved a friendly family unit, albeit a sort of sunny clearing surrounded by jungle thickets of ex-wives and discontented siblings. I grew up and left home, but went back often, feeling never excluded. Coochie would have seen Malcolm into a happy old age. But when she was 40 and the twins 11, a hit-and-run driver swerved her car off the road and downhill onto rocks. Coochie and Peter had been killed outright. Robin, the elder twin, suffered brain damage. I had been away. Malcolm was in his office. A policeman went to him to tell him, and he let me know soon after. I'd learnt the meaning of grief on that drizzly afternoon, and still mourned them all, their loss irreparable. On the October evening of Malcolm's telephone call, I glanced at them as usual as I went to bed, their three bright faces grinning out from a silver frame on my chest of drawers. Robin lived, just, in serene twilight in a nursing home. I went to see him now and again. He no longer looked like the boy in the photograph, but was 5 years older, growing tall, empty-eyed. I wonder what Malcolm could possibly want. He was rich enough to buy anything he needed, maybe, only maybe, excluding the whole of Fort Knox. I couldn't think of anything I could do for him that he couldn't get from anyone else. Newmarket, I thought. The sales? Newmarket was all very well for me because I'd been working as an assistant to a racehorse trainer. But Newmarket for Malcolm? Malcolm never gambled on horses, only on gold. Malcolm had made several immense consecutive fortunes from buying and selling the hard yellow stuff, and had years ago reacted to my stated choice of occupation by saying merely, "Horses? Racing? God Lord! Well, that's what you want, my boy. Off you go. You don't expect me to know the first thing about anything." And as far as I knew, he was still as ignorant of the subject as he'd been all along. Malcolm and Newmarket bloodstock sales simply didn't mix. Not the Malcolm I'd known, anyway. I drove the next day to the isolated Suffolk town whose major industry was the sport of kings. And among the scattered, purposeful crowd, found my father standing bareheaded in the area outside the sale ring building, eyes intently focused on a catalogue. He looked just the same. Brushed grey hair, smooth brown vicuña knee-length overcoat, charcoal business suit, silk tie, polished black shoes, confidently bringing his city presence into the casual sophistication of the country. It was a golden day, crisp and clear, the sky a cold, cloudless blue. I walked across to him in my own brand of working clothes, cavalry tulle trousers, checked wool shirt, padded olive-green jacket, tweed cap, a surface contrast that went personality deep. "Good afternoon," I said. He raised his eyes and gave me a stare as blue as the sky. "So you came." "Well, Yes. He nodded vaguely, looking me over.
You look older, he said.
3 years.
3 years.
And a crooked nose. He observed it dispassionately.
I suppose you broke that falling off a horse.
No. You broke it.
Did I?
He seemed only mildly surprised.
Well, you deserved it.
I didn't answer. He shrugged.
You want some coffee?
Okay.
We hadn't touched each other, I thought. Not a hug, not a handshake, not a passing pat on the arm.
3 years' silence couldn't easily be bridged.
He set off, not in the direction of the regular refreshment room, but towards one of the private rooms set aside for the privileged. I followed in his footsteps, remembering, wryly, that it took him roughly 2 minutes any time to talk himself into the plushest recesses, wherever.
The Newmarket sales building was in the form of an amphitheatre, sloping banks of seats rising all round from the ground-level ring where each horse was led round while being auctioned. Underneath the seating, and in a large adjacent building, were rooms used as offices by auctioneers and bloodstock agents, and as entertainment rooms by commercial firms such as Ebury Jewellers, Malcolm's present willing hosts. I was used only to the basic concrete boxes of the bloodstock agents' offices. Ebury's space was decorated in contrast as an expensive showroom, with well-lit glass display cases round three walls, shining with silver and sparkling with baubles. Everything locked away safely, but temptingly visible. Down the centre of the room, on brown wall-to-wall carpeting, stood a long polished table surrounded with armed, leather-covered dining chairs. Before each chair was neatly laid a leather-edged blotter alongside a gold-tooled tub containing pens, suggesting that all any client needed to provide here was his checkbook. A smooth young gentleman welcomed Malcolm with enthusiastic tact and offered drinks and goodies from the well-stocked buffet table which filled most of the fourth wall. Lunch, it seemed, was an all-day affair. Malcolm and I took cups of coffee and sat at the table, I, at any rate, feeling awkward. Malcolm fiddled with his spoon. A large, loud lady came in and began talking to the smooth young man about having one of her dogs modelled in silver. Malcolm raised his eyes to them briefly, and then looked down again at his cup. "What sort of help?" I said.
I suppose I expected him to say he wanted help in some way with horses, in view of the venue he'd chosen. But it seemed to be nothing as straightforward.
"I want you beside me," he said.
I frowned, puzzled. "How do you mean?"
"Beside me," he said. "All the time."
"I don't understand."
"I don't suppose you do," he said.
He looked up at my face.
"I'm going to travel a bit. I want you with me."
I made no fast reply, and he said abruptly, explosively,
"Damn it, Ian, I'm not asking the world. A bit of your time, a bit of your attention, that's all."
"Why now? And why me?"
"You're my son."
He stopped fiddling with the spoon and dropped it onto the blotter where it left a round stain. He leaned back in his chair.
"I trust you."
He paused.
"I need someone I can trust."
"Why?"
He didn't tell me why. He said, "Can't you get some time off from work? Have a holiday."
I thought of the trainer I'd just left, whose daughter had made my job untenable because she wanted it for her fiancé. There was no immediate need for me to find another place, save for paying the rent. At 33, I'd worked for three different trainers, and had lately come to feel I was growing too old to carry on as anyone's assistant. The natural progression was towards becoming a trainer myself, a dicey course without money.
"Now, what are you thinking?" Malcolm asked.
"Roughly, whether you would lend me £500,000.
"No,"
he said. I smiled. "That's what I thought."
"I'll pay your fares and your hotel bills."
Across the room, the loud lady was giving the smooth young man her address. A waitress had arrived and was busy unpacking fresh sandwiches and more alcohol onto the